This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. This is Kenai Conversation. I'm your host, Sabine Pooks. You're listening to our conversation with historian Clark Fair and Central Peninsula Hospital spokesperson Bruce Richards. We're going through the windy, tumultuous origin story of Central Peninsula Hospital, as chronicled by Fair in his recent Peninsula Clarion series for the hospital's 50th anniversary. Okay, so Kenai A wins, but Kenai A, of course, is not where the hospital is right now.
That's also correct. So what happened?
Yeah.
So Isaac was upset. There is a lot of dissension caused by this, and I'm lumping a few things together here, but what essentially it boiled down to is that the association brought on a publicity guy. His name was Merrill Mail. He was a radio personality out of California and had been on the radio in Anchorage quite a bit. And he was very enthusiastic and wrote a lot of releases with a lot of exclamation marks in them and capital letters. And he was trying to get people excited, but the excitement was starting to die down. I had said that there had been almost 400 members, but that was dwindling as people were losing. They wanted to see progress, and here it is now in 1963, and you know, it's been 2 years and nothing's really happening, and that's sort of natural. People start to lose enthusiasm if things aren't continuing. And so they got together, a lot of the particulars got together, and they said, look, how about if we bring in two consultants and they both evaluate Kenai A, and if they think that Kenai A is not suitable, what they should do is then pick an alternative and say why it would be better. Sounds basic enough. But the board for the Central Kenai Peninsula Hospital Association got together after this meeting, and they said, no, this sounds like a setup, I think. And so what they did was they agreed to have one consultant brought in, and they wanted Merrill Mail to find him. Well, and this to me is one of the funniest parts of this whole story, because early in 1963, Dr. Isaac had met a Los Angeles-based hospital designer and builder named Milton W. Eckhouse, and they had become friends.
What
through,
a name.
Right. through, and he'd built a lot of hospitals. Hmm. He was very, very knowledgeable and very good at what he did. They had started out as kind of acquaintances, and they had developed a friendship over the course of several months, and they were writing back and forth very regularly, sometimes two or three times a week. And Merrill Mail went and got on the phone and called Providence Hospital. He called all these professionals that he could find, and he said, all right, here's what we want to do. We want to bring in this consultant. We want somebody who really knows hospitals and all this. Do you have somebody that you could, you know, endorse, somebody you could recommend? And they all kept recommending the same guy. So he got on the phone and he called the guy. It was Milton W. Eckhouse. And so when Mail then hangs up after talking to Eckhouse, he calls up Isaac, and he's all excited because he's got this guy who's coming in. Isaac doesn't say, oh yeah, I know him, he's my buddy. He just says, that sounds all right. And then Eckhouse comes in. I think it's November 1963. He does his evaluation. He turns it into the Central Kenai Peninsula Hospital Association. And in December, they roundly reject it. And the problem, they say, is one, it's bias, and two, it's wrong. And they question all of his findings, because he says, you know, there's nothing really wrong with Kenai A, but he says, my experience tells me that if you are not in the demographic and geographic center of your constituency, you have got a problem, and that's not it. And he says the demographic and geographic center is about where the Y is in Soldotna.
And is this true? At the time?
It is. And it's also the center. Everybody's got to, if you're driving, everybody's got to go through there.
Sure.
You're going to Homer, you're going to Kasilof, you're going to Cooper Landing, Seward. That's the center. Kenai people were not happy to hear that. And they very shortly fired Merrill Mail. They, like I said, they rejected Eckhouse's findings, and they began to go ahead with planning to make the site Kenai A.
And when you say they, you're still talking about the association.
I am.
Which is Kenai heavy.
Yes, it's not as Kenai heavy because I've
skipped. There's been this attrition of folks.
Well, there's also been a lot of pressure for them to bring in people from other communities. So it's not all Kenai, but Kenai still has a huge influence on this on this board and this association. But the most important thing is that this is when Isaac had had enough. And he decided he was going to start his own association, and that is the Peninsula General Hospital Association. And he figures that that's going to be the name of the hospital, Peninsula General Hospital. And so he starts a new association, gets incorporated.
Are they warring associations?
Oh, my gosh, yes, yes. Because immediately he goes and talks to Jack Farnsworth. The Farnsworth family pretty much owned the whole Y, except for where Buckets is now. That was owned by the Mullins. But the rest was all Farnsworth. Farnsworth owned a giant chunk. I mean, they owned over where Fred Meyer is now and Midas and Banks. And yeah, they were bigwigs. And even then, they had a lot of control because they had a lot of property that was right in the center and right where everything went through. They were offering two and a half acre parcels for $30,000. I think it was $6,500 a piece originally, and it was pared down to $30,000. So they that was where it was going to happen. In fact, they even did a little bit of clearing in there. They started to sort of rough out the area where the hospital was going to go. And, Isaac said, look, we're doing this. We've already got a spot. We've got the property. We've got the rights to it. We're going ahead. We're going to have a real hospital, and it's going to be right here. Well, the Central Kenai Peninsula Hospital Association didn't think so. And so then there was another war in the papers, you know, people fighting back and forth, and not just in the papers, but mostly there. And so you had the opinion began to generally or slowly shift toward Isaac. People began to think that that was the better plan because of the reasons of it being more centrally located and all that. And he slowly began to win people over. And they also got the Small Business Administration to give them funding or agree to give them funding. And that was big because it looked like this could really happen. And he also had Eckhouse. And Eckhouse was going to design it and build it. And he had given them a price tag of $400,000. Everything seemed reasonable. And so the Central Kenai Peninsula Hospital Association began to just sort of fade away until eventually, I think around 1965, probably 66, it disbanded. But we don't have to go into a lot of detail here, but eventually they decided not to do the Farnsworth property and instead to get property from Joe and Mickey Fay, and that's where the hospital sits today. And it was a better price. It was 10 acres for $10,000 rather than 5 acres for $30,000. It had supposedly like 40 feet of gravel, 40-foot thick bed of gravel, so it was going to have no problem with drainage or foundations or anything. And it had almost all been cleared before because Joe Fay was a horseman, and he had horse fields, and he had, you know, hay pastures. And go ahead.
Well, it's so interesting that after kind of this really heated battle between these factions, essentially, of people who wanted a hospital here, it kind of went out with a whimper, it sounds like, and everyone was just kind of like, all right, Soldotna it is.
I wouldn't call it a whimper. I would say that in 1963, Dr. Alan Barr became Kenai's second ever resident physician. And by 1964, they were breaking ground on what they said was going to be a Kenai hospital. So they were not going to lie down and let this go. And this was not the Central Kenai Peninsula Hospital Association. This was another group. And over the course of the years between 65 and, say, 68, you had groups in Nikiski saying, well, we're going to build a hospital out here. No, we're going to build a hospital here in Kenai. So they never gave up. They were very angry that they were not going to get this hospital. And the thought of it happening that way and Soldotna getting something else really didn't sit well with them. So I would say it was not a whimper at all.
Wow. So there's actually a third group of folks.
There were more than three. There were the group that wanted to put the hospital right in town in Soldotna. I don't know if you know where Dr. Peter Hansen's his office was for many, many years, but that was where there was going to be a Kenai hospital there too. I mean, they tried all kinds of things. I don't think a lot of them could just stomach the idea that I think some of them in Kenai, and if it had been on the other way, it would have been people in Soldotna saying the same thing. But I think it was particularly egregious to Kenai people that this upstart little community of Soldotna, which just started in 47, and Kenai had this long history as a village long before it incorporated and became a city. They just couldn't stand the idea that Soldotna was going to get something, and they hated that. And as Bruce said, in 64, when the boroughs were formed, they were going to get the borough building. And I mean, on and on. It's just like, this Soldotna pipsqueak, right? They really didn't care for that at all. And so they kept trying to find ways to make themselves have the hospital. Because I think some of them thought, I would rather suffer and die than have to go to a hospital in Soldotna. And I would say that that's not a gross exaggeration.
Oh, my goodness.
For some people.
Wow. That's pretty brutal.
Yeah, it really is.
So, and I don't want to linger too hard on this part of the story, but I know there was an earthquake.
Yeah.
And then there were also some financial troubles. Can you give us a little snapshot of what that was like without maybe going too far into the weeds here?
Right. So they've got everything set. The Small Business Administration says we're gonna give you some money. Things look like it's gonna progress, and then the earthquake hits, and everything.
1964.
March 27th, 1964, 5:31 p.m. or something like that. It's devastating. I mean, it screws up everybody's plans. Almost all loans, almost everything comes to a screeching halt because we got to fix what we got now. We got to fix all kinds of infrastructure. I mean, nobody's getting anything. And that doesn't really change until into 1965. In 65, it looks like the loan is going to happen. But the one other snag is that the new association that Isaac helped develop, remember, he's a practicing physician, so once again, he's not on the board. The board is making decisions without him, and they decide, you know, we don't want to use Eckhouse. We think it would be better and more popular, more palatable, if we would go to someone in Anchorage. And so they bring in an Anchorage architect and an Anchorage...
Because where's Eckhouse from?
He's from Los Angeles, so that doesn't sit well. So they bring in Lynn Forrest, the architect from Anchorage. They bring in Robert Clay, the builder from Anchorage. And it looks like things are going to happen. In I think, September of 65, the governor comes to Soldotna. He digs a few shovelfuls of dirt. It's just a ceremonial thing. They put them in a can. Bruce has got a couple of the cans at the hospital there. They've got a label that was handmade by somebody named Totfest. I don't know his first name. They in March of 66, there's the official groundbreaking. A whole bunch of bulldozers, caterpillars come in and they scrape all the topsoil off. They begin creating a gravel pad so that they can put the foundation there. And then the governor comes back in September of 66, lays the cornerstone and puts a time capsule in there. And I think for a moment, Bruce ought to talk about the time capsule.
Yeah. So this is 1966. I'd seen photos of Dr. Isaac standing next to this, or some folks that I didn't know until Clark actually identified them. But I'd always seen this photo, and you know, it's got 1966 engraved in this block, and it's right on the corner, and you know, so it's kind of one of those things you see and you think, oh, that's cool. And while I'm working with Clark on this story, I'm kind of like digging through everybody at the hospital saying, hey, do you guys have any of the historical stuff? I've worked at the hospital 10 years, so a lot of this precedes me as far as any of the work that was done. And somebody found a box and it had one of those transparent plastic pages that you slip slides into. And there was probably 15 or 20 slides in this page. And of course you're holding them up to the light and you can't really tell what they are, but I figured out that it looked like Governor Egan, and they're color, which is very cool because everything I'd seen up to now was black and white. So somebody at work actually had a scanner and scanned the slides, and so we got to look at them. It was amazing. So we took them and sent them off to Anchorage to get a higher resolution scan of them. And these pictures were just amazing to me. I mean, you know, here's Governor Egan. You know, he's standing at a microphone. The person who took these photos, I don't think, was a professional photographer. There's nothing staged. There's a lot of strange positioning, but it kind of made it even neater for me, you know.
Very authentic.
Yes. And so, I mean, you know, it got some pictures of the crowd. You can see the school bus where the Kenai High School band showed up. There's a helicopter sitting right behind the bus. It looks like it's running. You can see the back rotor tail whirling around. And but the significant thing to me personally was that in this photo, I can see where this block is, and there's enough of background in it that I can actually tell where this block is located at the hospital. And I figured that out because I recognized a couple of things in the photo in the background. One of them was a house that belonged to the Woods family. And I went to school with the younger Woods, and Ricky was older, but, and you can see, Soldaten Elementary School, and you can see I can't remember if the clinic was in there or not, but, 66, it would have been, right?
Are you talking?
The original clinic was there in the background, right? Right. So anyways, I got some bearings, and, anyways, long story short, I went around and I went to our maintenance director at our hospital and, you know, who knows all the nooks and crannies of the hospital. I said, hey, I think I know if this cornerstone still exists, I think I know where it is. 'Cause the old part of the hospital is still there. And so we walked out and I said, it's right here in this corner, but of course you can't see it. And you know, there's been lots of changes at the hospital and, but he said, yeah, I don't think it's there. I said, man, I'm telling you, I know it's right here because I grew up here. I know that house. Look at this picture. That blue house is the Woods house. I've been by there on my bicycle a million times. I know where I'm at. I know where this is. And he left, you know, we kind of parted ways and went back and we're going to study it some more. And then he called me and he goes, yeah, you might be right. Long story short, we went out and there's some bricks that have been added, you know, a facade, if you will. And we cut a hole in those bricks. First, we dug down to see if it was right below the ground level. Wasn't there. So then we cut these bricks out that you can't get anymore. So it's like, you know, we're getting ready to cut into these bricks that you can't really replace. So we have a few extras that we'd steal from a wall that's internal that nobody would see if we stole them. So it was okay. The CEO's gone, and I got people out here tearing the corner off of a hospital. And lo and behold, there it is. And
you knew the location.
I was right.
You were right.
I was.
Moral of the story.
Right, right. The thing that's important is that I was right. No, it's just very cool that the original cornerstone was there. But also, the cornerstone wasn't a cornerstone anymore. It's moved in one half. I think it's one half now. Yeah, one half of a block. And I was going, well, wait a minute. In the photos, you can see it with Governor Egan, with Dr. Isaac. It's a cornerstone. It's right on the corner. And now it's exactly one half block in. So all I can surmise is, well, all I can surmise is that they had this whole dog and pony show where all the politicians and everybody showed up And then when they left, somebody went by and said, yeah, well, we got to go up a few more rows before we put it back on. Mm. And, you know, they have to alternate a half block, full block every other row. And so it ended up being on one that's not on the corner. So, but you can see the governor putting some papers in. It's kind of a time capsule. There's three holes in it, and you can see him putting some papers in it. And we haven't gotten those out yet. That's kind of part of the whole thing we'll do sometime this year. It's the 50th anniversary, and we'll get in there. But we did locate it. Actually went inside the CEO's office. He's still not, you know, he was off that week visiting family.
So you're poking around.
Tore his wall apart. We went in and sure tore the sheetrock off the wall, located the brick. And so we were going to make it all ready to, so when we do expose it and take the contents out, that it was easier to do. So it's all ready to go and everything. And I got this wall put back together. I have a picture of this. I'm going to write about this in a little more detail, just leave some of that history behind, you know, as we talked about earlier. But yeah, so the original cornerstone's still in the hospital. It's not really a cornerstone anymore. I think there's a story there that somebody knows. Maybe they're around. I don't know, but yeah, it's there.
That's fascinating, and it's so cool that you were able to find this place. It's kind of like a treasure hunt.
And I don't think I would have had I not grown up here. Mm. You know, if you see these pictures, and some of them are in the document on our website, you know, it shows you can see stuff in the background, and that's what helped me get my bearings to where this cornerstone was located.
And, of course, you know, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary, but the year we're talking about right now is 1966. So we still have 5 years to go. What gives? What's happening in this 5 years? Why is it still taking so long?
Well, the construction begins, and the without making this too complicated, the Small Business Administration says, we'll give you this $350,000, but you got to come up with the rest. Well, they had some pledges, and they had some people promise some money, and they had some different kinds of things, some donations, you know, like in-kind donations, but they didn't really have the money that was going to be necessary. And not only that, but when it was redesigned, so to speak, when Lynn Forrest developed his plan for the hospital, it wasn't a $400,000 hospital. It was a nearly $600,000 hospital. So $350,000 wasn't going to cut it. And the Small Business Administration said, well, we're not going to pay anything until you come up with some more money. Well, there's work already begun. And Robert Clay and Lynn Forrest and all the subcontractors, they're expecting to be paid. They didn't get their first check from the Small Business Administration until New Year's Eve on 1966, excuse me, Christmas Eve, 1966. And so, you know, you create this problem. It's clear that they're going to run out of money before they can finish this, but they keep working. They're starting to edge closer to spring, and they've got 60%, maybe 70% of the project done. And they don't have any money left, and it's a big deal. So if you are out of money and you can't raise more money, who's going to lend you more money if you aren't paying off what you borrowed the first time? Small Business Administration is expecting some money back. If there's no hospital, they can't raise any money. How are you going to generate any funds if you don't have a finished hospital? The hospital was supposed to be finished. There were a lot of things that were supposed to work out, but they didn't work out. And so the hospital building, the shell of it, sits empty for the better part of 3 years while they're trying to hash all this out. And there's a lot of problems, obviously. But the upshot of it all is that the borough decides, under Chairman Harold Pomeroy, decides to step in. And it's a complicated process how that happens, but Pomeroy does a lot of research, and I have to give him a lot of credit for talking to a lot of the right people. One of the things that he did was he talked to a guy named Harry Malm, M-A-L-M, and he was the Lutheran, I'd have to, the Lutheran Hospitals and Home Society of America, And they were known for running hospitals. I mean, that's just kind of what they did. They would operate hospitals. And he talked to Harry Malm, and he said, he explained the whole problem. And Malm said, well, you know, the unfortunate thing is that there's no money tree that we can shake and get what we need to make things happen. He said, until you get real buy-in from the community that you're trying to serve, this isn't going to get any better. Well, that's not exactly what Pomeroy wanted to hear, but it was also, it motivated him to go in the right direction. Meanwhile, Small Business Administration is saying, okay, you got this much time and we're going to foreclose. We're going to take possession of the building, the property, the whole thing. This isn't working. So they've got to do something fast, because Pomeroy has done a lot of research, and he's determined that that property, if there's a hospital sitting on it, is going to be worth $1.4 million. You can't just give that away. You can't just let them sell it piecemeal. You get nothing out of it. So he decides to take action. And again, there's a lot more to this, but by 1969, they decide that they're going to create a hospital service area. And they have a vote. I think it's in April, and the voters say, yes, we would like to have a hospital service area. So they have a second vote in October, and that is, are you willing, as a hospital service area, to assume the $350,000 debt that we owe the SBA? And if they said no, the SBA would have foreclosed. I feel pretty confident in that. But they said yes. So they have a service area. They have a service area board. They have agreed to tax themselves in order to pay off the debt, and things begin an upward climb. They have to hire a new architect to finish the building. They have to hire a new contractor. It costs about $800,000 more to finish the hospital and get it up and running, but it happens. And I think that a lot of that should be credited to Harold Pomeroy for pushing that through. I mean, he wasn't the only one by any stretch, but he was integral in making that happen. And then the hospital finished. They had a grand opening on June the 12th, 1971. On June the 21st, 1971, they opened their doors. 14 minutes later, they got an obstetrics patient, and the first baby was Dustin Lee Moore, Poole, and that took us right up to the, I mean, it got done. It was messy. It was really, really messy.
14 minutes, too, after the hospital.
14.
What a testament to how necessary it was, huh?
Yeah, well, not only that, but they had, I don't have these numbers in front of me, but within the first week or two weeks, I think, they'd had a large number of emergencies, you know, ER patients. They had all kinds of proof in those first 2 weeks just how necessary a hospital was. And I mean, like you said, the rest is history.
I have a million more questions for you, but we only have a few short minutes. And so I just want to ask both of you before we close, what were some of the most surprising things you learned in this process? Any specific factoids or anecdotes that stick out to you? What are some of your takeaways? Maybe Bruce, we can start with you.
Well, I think, you know, it's hard to cover all this ground without, as we talked about earlier before we got on the air, about getting in the weeds. But I think, you know, and Clark knows this and would agree that, you know, it's the resolve of Dr. Isaac in this whole process was amazing. And having a hospital here today is because of Dr. Isaac. I mean, if you saw that box that Clark talks about with all those manila folders and all those letters, it's sitting on my desk right now. And I've read a bunch of those, and it's truly amazing the work that he did to keep this going, even when interest was waning and people were falling away from it. I mean, there's letters in there from University of Nebraska, I believe, where he was trying to shake down his old medical school folks trying to get money, you know, saying, hey, I'm up here, we've run into a bind, you know of anybody that can help us finance this. You know, I mean, he was doing
everything. And it's just amazing, you know, the amount of effort and work that he put into it. In addition to being a full-time physician, you know, flying babies to Seward and you know, doing all of those things. It's just an amazing, was an amazing individual, and we should all be really grateful for that.
Do we know what became of him? Like, once the hospital opened, kind of, what was his path after that?
When Isaac made arrangements for Isaac's association made arrangements for the purchase of land from Joe Fay, he also purchased an additional 5 acres for he and Dr. Gady to open a new medical dental clinic. And so that medical dental clinic, the building is still there. I don't know exactly what it is right now.
It's still a clinic, and it's actually owned by the hospital now.
Okay. So that was open in 1968, February, I think. And my father moved over there, and another dentist moved over there. And I think there was a third doctor, too. I believe that originally it had 3 physicians and 2 dentists. And Dr. Isaac practiced there for a long, long time. And Isaac retired as a physician, and I don't remember the year that he died, but it was between 2007 and 2010.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Wow. So, and then Clark, I want to ask you the same question, kind of what was some of the things that, you know, interested you the most about this intensely well-researched and deep dive into this history here?
I think that one of the things is that when you grow up in an area, and I've pretty much lived here all my life, a lot of things happen around you and you don't always understand them and you don't always appreciate the full magnitude of them. And one of the things that I always knew was that there was a rivalry between Soldotna and Kenai. And I knew that when I'd go to a sporting event, I could feel it. That was to be expected. I'd heard things about it when I was a Clarion reporter back in the 80s. Our owner lived in Kenai, and his wife, she's a sweet lady, she intensely hated Soldotna. She said that she would rather drive all the way to Anchorage to get something rather than to go just down the road to Soldotna, even if she knew they had it. She did not want to shop in Soldotna. She didn't want anything to do with Soldotna. And there were people who felt the same way in Soldotna about Kenai. There was just this sort of intractable dislike. And so it was really interesting to me to read some of these things that people would say back and forth and to see that the depths that it went. And now when I was working for Jenny Nyman back on the Readout Reporter, I did I think it was five part series on the origin of the Borough Building. And it was the same thing. I mean, they just sniping back and forth at each other and putting out ads in the newspaper saying why we're better and why this is a bad choice and on and on and on. And, you know, they have fought over all kinds of things. And, you know, Soldotna would say, well, you've got your industry out here and you've got your docks and you've got the airport and you've got this and you've got this. And then the Kenai would say, yeah, but you've got the borough, you got the whole seat of government and the school district. And now you got the hospital. And then in 1980, Soldotna opened its own high school and everybody didn't have to go to Kenai anymore because you said you had to go start at Kenai. I had to go to Kenai all the way through. And I live out in Sterling, you know, it was like, It was nice to have a school in Soldotna, but it took a long time for these things to kind of ameliorate. I think that in the sporting world, that rivalry is still pretty intense. But I think overall, even though there are definitely people who don't like Kenai or don't like Soldotna, I think it's mellowed compared to what it used to be. I think it's beginning to be seen more as a big community where we all kind of need each other rather than this sort of us versus them thing.
So we have maybe some fewer people nowadays who would rather, you know, just let themselves bleed out, then go to the hospital in Soldotna.
I think so.
And that's all the time we have. A huge thank you to Clark Fair and Bruce Richards for their time today. We'll have a link to Fair's Clarion series in the online version of this story at kdll.org. You were listening to Kenai Conversation. I'm Sabine Pooks.